The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I'm Ollie Mann, and this is Tech Weekly. On today's show, we're going to look back at the last 6 years of Bitcoin, the booms, the busts, and the bags of blow. Digital currency was set to revolutionise banking, but last time I checked, I was still paying off my mortgage in pounds. So will Bitcoin ever go mainstream? And what about its heir apparent, the blockchain? And what the hell is a blockchain? Our resident Bit Supremo, Alex Hearn, will be here to take our hand and lead us through the cryptographical maze that is Bitcoin. He'll talk to Nathaniel Popper, who's written a new book about the history of the currency, and electronic money maestro Dave Birch from Hyperion on how it's not Bitcoin itself, but the technology underpinning the whole thing, which could be the surprise winner in the battle for the future. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, Bitcoin had a really high profile when it was linked to the notorious drug marketplace Silk Road, but it hasn't really since then managed to take off in the sort of ways people had been predicting. It's been held up as something which can overthrow banks, governments, corporations. I'd say so far it hasn't done much other than liberate access to cannabis. Alex Hearn, is that fair?
It does rather feel it. Even the smaller things, maybe you weren't expecting it to overthrow a bank, but expecting it to be able to help people move currency out of countries with quite hefty currency controls. That was one of the big things that people were promoting Bitcoin as this thing that it could do back in the peak of the media attention around mid-2013. In practice, there don't seem to be much evidence that's what it's been used for. By and large, if you want to get money out of a country with currency controls, you do it the old-fashioned way, suitcases full of dollar bills. That's the best way to do it. Bitcoin, technologically, is a far simpler, more elegant way of doing it, but in practice, no one quite wants to put large amounts of money in this weird pseudo-currency.
Now, as you say, there was a kind of media frenzy about Bitcoin a couple of years back, and of course The Guardian was part of that, and we did a series of specials on Tech Weekly all about Bitcoin and what the repercussions and consequences might be. Nonetheless, you know, people can go back in the archive and find that, but give us, since we're here right now, the sort of York Notes version of what it is and how you make it, first of all, before we have a long discussion about what happens next.
Bitcoin is a cryptographic peer-to-peer digital currency. The cryptographic part of it means that it works on much the same technology as encrypted email or even encrypted web surfing, the technology that lets you visit a bank website safely. The basic way that works is if I have something and need to give it to you on the internet, that's actually quite hard because you don't know I'm me and I don't know you're you. So the way that works is rather than saying, here, Ollie, have a Bitcoin, I sign digitally a note, essentially, saying, I, Alex Hearn, give Ollie Mann some of my Bitcoin. But that's only solves half the problem, because who am I telling? Well, in Bitcoin, the second answer to the solution is this peer-to-peer element. I tell everyone. They all update their records, and the system moves on. In effect, the role of the bank in this system is carried out by everyone and no one at the same time.
In reality, will anyone ever go and buy a Porsche with a Bitcoin?
So in reality, some people have, but by and large, the people making serious purchases with Bitcoin for non-press attention reasons are doing so because they have a lot of money in Bitcoin. Either they gambled on it when it was, you know, not worth much in US dollars and then the value went up 100-fold and now they find themselves rich, or they work in an industry that uses Bitcoin, or they're a drug dealer. They have a lot of Bitcoin and they want to do stuff with it. It's expensive and inefficient to have to convert it all the way back to pounds or dollars before you spend it. So yeah, if you find someone willing to take Bitcoin for a Porsche, you may as well buy it with that currency.
Okay, but we are going to look in this episode about what it has achieved so far and what might be around the corner in the future. And it's not necessarily what you might expect. There's a bloke called Nathaniel Popper who's written a book called Digital Gold, The Untold Story of Bitcoin. You've been speaking to him.
Yeah, so Nathaniel's book takes a look at Bitcoin from then to now. It starts with Satoshi Nakamoto, the anonymous inventor of the currency, who released in 2008 a short paper describing this peer-to-peer cryptographic currency. In January 2009, the Bitcoin network was turned on for the first time. It's not been turned off since. So the first thing I asked him is what the world was like back in 2009, the heady days when Bitcoin was created.
Well, going back, I think the community that kind of fed into this was really this group of privacy activists that gathered around this online community called the Cypherpunks. And these were folks who were worried about the ability to sort of snoop on ordinary citizens, whether the government or corporate interest. They picked up very quickly that it was digital financial transactions that provided as much of a window as anything into a person's day-to-day activities. You know, your credit card bill shows so much about what you are doing in the course of a day. And so there had been these efforts for many years to create a kind of anonymous digital cash that people could use and that wasn't traceable. When Bitcoin appeared in late 2008, this was right after the financial crisis. What was on everybody's mind was, you know, the bailouts of the big banks and the failures of central banks to spot or stop the financial crisis. So you had this desire for a new money took on much broader significance because there was so much skepticism at the time of the sort of central authorities and really authorities of any sort at that point.
How much of that initial design of Bitcoin, which is still almost entirely the design of Bitcoin as it runs today, how much of that is influenced by that milieu that it was birthed into?
I think that the basic shape of it was formed in opposition to, you know, central authorities. It was about decentralization. The irony, as the story has moved along, is that it's found its way back to a kind of regulated system in which banks are playing an important role. But the design of the system, even for the banks, what's attractive is that it's this decentralized system that takes advantage of a lot of the same things that the internet does.
So after it was introduced, it puttered along doing not much for a bit. Most people will have heard about it almost 3 years after that, in 2013, when there was a massive boom and bust. But that wasn't the first boom and bust. I mean, Bitcoin has had this all through its history. Can you talk us through sort of the first one, two, three booms that came in this prehistory?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what makes the story of Bitcoin so fascinating, is that people inscribe these utopian ambitions and hopes onto Bitcoin, and it kind of inevitably fails those ambitions. And I think the first time this came up was really 2.5 years into Bitcoin's existence when the Silk Road came online. And up until then, you really couldn't do anything with a Bitcoin. You could mine them on your computer and you could send them around to other people who were toying around with Bitcoin, but they really weren't worth anything. And when Ross Ulbricht brought the Silk Road online, suddenly you could do something with your Bitcoins. And not only could you do something with your Bitcoins, you could do something with your Bitcoins that you couldn't do with your pounds or dollars. You could buy drugs online. That was not possible with a credit card or with PayPal. And so the Silk Road suddenly made Bitcoin very attractive, certainly for everybody who wanted to use the Silk Road. But I think a lot of other people started to look at this and realize this is a new technology that allows something that we couldn't do before. And so you had pretty quickly in the months after Silk Road came online, a big run-up in price. The sort of infrastructure and ecosystem that had grown up around Bitcoin just wasn't ready to handle this number of people coming in. And so Mt. Gox, which at that point was already based in Tokyo with Mark Karpeles running it, this young Frenchman living in Tokyo, it just groaned under the weight of all these people buying and selling and, you know, essentially had to shut down after the Silk Road got all this attention. And so the price went from $30 down to basically a penny in a couple of hours. It just drove home how sort of immature this technology was.
And so, I mean, if drugs were broadly the cause of the first big Bitcoin boom, the next one, if you can link it to any individual thing, seems to have been foreign exchange, because the next big expansion in Bitcoin's price and in awareness of it came around the time of the European banking crisis. There was a lot of talk of Bitcoin being used to get money out of Cyprus as its banks were failing, of it saving the Greek economy somehow. I mean, is foreign exchange the sort of acceptable face of what you can do with Bitcoin that you can't do with anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that has long been the view of where this was going to be used, not for illegal means. It was going to be used by people who wanted to move in and out of national currencies in different places, and that Bitcoin provided a much more seamless, efficient way to do that. And there was this easy explanation that Cyprus is what caused that. I think in my look at this story, what I found was that that also happened to be the time where Silicon Valley folks, you know, very wealthy venture capitalists, were getting interested in this and buying really quite large sums of Bitcoins, you know, $1 million. In that realm, you know, when Bitcoins weren't worth very much, $1 million, somebody trying to buy $1 million in the course of a day could push the price up very significantly. And so behind the scenes, you know, behind all this conversation about the Cyprus banking crisis, you had guys out in Silicon Valley who were quietly buying a lot of Bitcoins. And I think that probably had more to do with the actual price increase in Bitcoin than anything going on in Cyprus. But Cyprus did provide a window into the kind of uses for Bitcoin that might exist in the future.
And so that was, I mean, that was broadly the second big boom and bust of Bitcoin. The boom came around the time of Cyprus, perhaps because of Silicon Valley. And then the bust came a few months later. There didn't seem to be a cause for that one, unlike the first one. There wasn't a massive hack that people pointed to. The bottom just fell out of the market. Is that right?
Well, it was actually, again, I think the immediate cause was, again, Mt. Gox and their problems. You know, Mark Karpeles had taken this company over in back in 2011, and he was still essentially running it himself as a one-man shop. I mean, he had employees, but he didn't know how to delegate responsibility, didn't trust his employees, and so he kept control of the basic code. And in April 2013, his systems just slowed down and he wasn't communicating with people. And it was really, you know, human error. This thing, again, it was such a potent reminder of the fact that this thing that was supposed to allow a way to do financial transactions without, you know, having to rely on the frailty of humans, you know, at every point, it's come back to these technologies that we build on top of it. And those always rely on humans with all of their frailties. That was the biggest cause of that collapse in April 2013.
It's an oversimplification, and perhaps it ignores the interesting points for a lot of people. But the history of Bitcoin has very publicly been booms and busts. I mean, what does maturity look like for this currency, for this technology?
I think that the booms and busts are, at their core, a signal of the speculation on what this technology is going to be. You know, the people have driven the price up because they get these big ideas in their heads about what Bitcoin is going to make possible. And it does make new types of financial transactions possible. And that's very exciting. And so that's why the people in Silicon Valley were pouring their money into this. They said, this could replace the whole financial system in a place like Argentina. But it often came crashing down because it wasn't there yet. And it's not today either. I mean, this is still something that all the Bitcoins in the world are worth $2 or $3 billion. I mean, this is a small American company, and it still is in this phase where people are imagining what it will be and placing their bets on that basis rather than making their bet based on what it is today. The price has been stable recently, but we still don't have all that much more clear of an idea of when or what is the real use that people are going to make with this on a daily basis.
And finally, put you on the spot for a very short answer. Will it ever reach that point?
I think that probably the more likely way in which this becomes mainstream is actually as kind of the back end of the financial system, in the same way that, you know, the cloud or the internet. We don't have to understand its inner workings. We don't have to understand the way packets of information are being sent around, but it might make financial transactions cheaper, more efficient, simpler than they are right now.
So that's a sort of. Thank you very much, Nathaniel. It's been fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
Really interesting to hear him suggest there that the technology behind Bitcoin might in some way be the solution to the banking system. I mean, that is a sector that has had a lot of crisis recently, a lot of regulation. Why do you think the banking industry would look for a solution that has a background history, as you've just highlighted, with drugs and illegal substances?
So the trick is not to look at Bitcoin as a currency, but to look at Bitcoin as a technology. The currency of it is, it's terrible. Like I said earlier, it's a really bad financial asset. It's volatile. The production of it is slow enough that there's not really any inflation, which you kind of want in currencies. You don't know who holds the damn thing. So any minute someone could sell millions of Bitcoin and crash the price. It's terrible. You don't want to be invested in it. But the technology behind it, the blockchain, which is the name for this distributed ledger that I was speaking about, the name for this record of where all the Bitcoins that have ever been spent reside, that's more interesting. Fundamentally, the banking system as we have it now, the back end of it is a really expensive machine to run. It involves servers all over the world, all doing security checks all the time. It involves cooperation of hundreds of different bodies across many different countries. And the blockchain, this scrappy peer-to-peer system, kind of replicates all of that quite well.
Okay, well, you did put some of this blockchain stuff to Dave Birch, who is from Consult Hyperion, a consultancy who advise on everything to do with electronic payments. And here's how your chat with him went.
Dave, I mean, Bitcoin fundamentally is a way of transferring money from one person to another. A lot of its fans talk about it as though it's the first thing that's ever let you do that with computers. But I mean, that's not strictly true, is it? There's a lot of other digital payment things out there. How does Bitcoin fit in that fairly crowded marketplace?
Well, I think probably the best way to look at it is as a position on a sort of evolutionary tree. I think perhaps, I don't want to sound like the old fart in this respect, but remember, there's a heritage to all of this stuff. People have been messing around with cryptography and money and cash replacement for a very long time. So we had things like e-cash and hash cash and all those kind of things. Bitcoin has kind of grown out of that heritage, and I've got no reason to suspect that it won't evolve into something else in time. So it isn't something that came out of nowhere and is perfected. It's a step on an evolutionary road, so to speak.
I mean, we had Nathaniel Popper in earlier talking about these libertarian roots of Bitcoin. If you're not a libertarian, if you don't, you know, fear central banks taking your money or inflating away all your savings, is there any reason to think that Bitcoin offers you anything?
Well, actually, I do rather fear central banks inflating away all of my savings. But the alternative that's put forward in that kind of more libertarian mold, money which is not under any form of democratic control, is not appealing to me. Mm. If you make cash sort of a globally untraceable system like that, you kind of embed a certain set of privileges. And it's not obvious to me that people who are, you know, rich, for example, should be allowed to move their money around unencumbered by any kind of democratic controls. Whatever you think of those things, that's an argument about democracy, not an argument about how the payment system works. So if you think that I should be allowed to send large amounts of money from here to Australia without the government or the police or my brother or anybody else knowing about it, well, then we're going to disagree about what type of implementation works best. And actually, one of the reasons why, to be completely honest, I've never been convinced by Bitcoin as a payment system is precisely because I don't think most people share those goals. Is it reasonable to say we should use technology to create money that has privacy, for example, as part of its DNA? Actually, I sort of agree with that. I do think money should be, you know, under some circumstances, private. That's not the same thing as being anonymous at all. should it be possible for people to create their own forms of money that work in particular circumstances, particular communities, you know, the Brixton pound or the Tottenham pound? Or, well, actually, I think that's true as well. And I think helping people to do that with technology is a way of devolving and decentralizing and actually giving people more say over certain elements of economic activity. So I'm not against some of those principles, but you know, it's not obvious to me that Bitcoin satisfies them all in the right way, hence my skepticism.
So, I mean, you said that you think this is one step on the evolutionary tree. How would you like to see Bitcoin changing, and how could it change? I mean, there's systems built into the currency that could let it take these lessons on board.
The future of Bitcoin probably isn't money any more than the future of money is Bitcoin. Which brings us to the other point, of course, which is about the underlying technology.
Yeah.
So one of the arguments in the Bitcoin world at the moment is whether some of the concepts from the underlying technical architecture, the blockchain, the distributed shared ledger that's at the heart of it, perhaps those could evolve in a separate direction. And actually, I'm more of a supporter of that frame of thinking. You can already see different kinds of blockchains coming into existence. Blockchains for smart contracts, for example, and pre-mined and blah, blah, blah. So you can already see different kinds of blockchains beginning to emerge. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see them develop into different kind of evolutionary niches. Why? Well, blockchains solve a very, very particular problem. They are a very computationally expensive way of transferring assets from one person to another. And the reason for that computational expense is to make the system resistant against subversion. So if you have a system where some of the players, or perhaps even only one of the players in a game, is a cheat, a blockchain, despite the computational expense, might be a better way of running the game, because a cheat or a small group of cheats can't, provided the game is big enough and there are enough honest players, they can't subvert it.
I mean, so this argument often gets summed up as Bitcoin's not the future, the blockchain is. That we're not going to see Bitcoin as a currency getting widespread acceptance, but we might see the blockchain, this idea of a decentralized ledger, underpinning technologies in the future. If that's the case, does that mean Bitcoin not being the future means it will be dead? Or is this currency aspect of it intrinsic to the larger blockchain world?
That's a really, really interesting question, because you could say, so to answer the first question, are there classes of problems where a blockchain might be appropriate? If the answer to that is yes, that doesn't necessarily mean that the blockchain, i.e. the Bitcoin blockchain, is the answer. There might be other blockchains that solve that. Does that mean there's no future for the Bitcoin blockchain? Actually, I don't think that's true either, because you already see innovations around colored coins and side chains and all this kind of thing, where people are using the Bitcoins themselves as essentially a kind of transport mechanism for moving other kinds of data and assets. But you could imagine that evolving in different directions. I think an analogy that's worth thinking about, if you're British, of course, is the steam engine. Because, you know, somebody made an incredible breakthrough to do something in a way that had never been done before and used a steam engine to pump water out of mines. Oh, my God, that's an amazing thing. And it was years later before people came up with the little improvements, like the governor and things like that, and the condenser. And then years again before people took it out and put it on wheels and started moving it around. And obviously we're in a phase of accelerated evolution, but nonetheless, the Bitcoin and the blockchain are in their early phases. They are a genuinely new way of solving a problem, but they're in their very early phases.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dave Bird.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
So
So there you have it. Dave says we're at the stage now where Bitcoin is equivalent to, in the development of the steam engine, something that is just pumping water out of mines. So what is the steam engine on a train motoring us around equivalent? What is the analogy? Where are we going, Alex?
Yeah, so, okay. So the pumping water out of mines is using this fantastic idea to replicate PayPal. You know, it doesn't take much imagination to go, okay, yeah, sending money back and forth, I can see how that's useful on the internet. And yet it's also a fairly marginal improvement, if it's even an improvement at all, on what we've got right now. But this technology, which is fundamentally me handing you a digitally signed piece of paper that says, I'm giving you some money. It's very easy to see, just it doesn't take much of a leap at all to say, well, what else could be on that piece of paper? And that's then one idea being built on Bitcoin, which is this idea of colored coins, it's called, where rather than writing on the Bitcoin, I'm giving you some money, you write on it, I'm giving you 50 shares in my company, or you write on it, I'm giving you title to this property, at 107 ABC Street. You then hand them the digitally signed piece of paper that says that, and, you know, provided you've set up contract law in the background that makes it all match up to the real world, you've then got a public digital ledger of shares in your company or of essentially the land registry, all built from the ground up for a digital world, for a public world, which for a lot of things is very, very positive, and for a world which can't be taken control of by any one individual actor.
Okay, Rainbow Bright, I'm going to take you down of your future fun cloud. If you're listening to this and you have been inspired to actually buy a Bitcoin right now, you're mad. But if you do want to do that, presumably it's a lot easier than it used to be.
Yeah, it is. It used to be that you would have to sign up to Bitcoin Exchange, which was a relatively shady place, and you'd have to often send off a scan of your passport to beat money laundering regulations and all of the rest. Now there's a few companies which are very serious, you know, Silicon Valley venture capital backed companies who will do most of that for you. The two biggest ones are Coinbase and Circle. Both of them have recently launched in the UK, and it really is as simple as ABC. You go sign up for an account, plug in credit card details, buy Bitcoin, and you're away. Finding somewhere to spend it, though, still is the hard part.
Plans dashed again. Well, you've blown my mind, basically, throughout this episode, Alex. Thank you very, very much for that. Thanks also to our guest, David Birch from Consult Hyperion, and the author, Nathaniel Popper. I've been Ollie Mann. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Ollie with a Y, MANN. The producer was Alana Chance. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.